So we're going to talk today about terrestrial planet formation. And this is intended as kind of like a discussion format. So feel free to interrupt me while I'm talking. And if you have something interesting that relates to what I'm saying, you know, feel free to chime in. So I'm going to talk for probably 20, 25 minutes, something like that. And so you can ask me questions during or after. And then Makiko Nagasawa is also going to talk for a little bit after that. So, all right, here we go. The main idea here is to present kind of the latest in terrestrial planet formation. And so, you know, basically, we're going to focus on the solar system and trying to figure out how we form, you know, these four little puny things in there that turn out to matter a lot for us. So kind of some motivation here, you know, how did the inner solar system form? Well, we don't know all the details. We can do a pretty good job already of reproducing Earth and Venus. They turn out to be pretty easy to reproduce in terms of their masses and their orbits. And if you're trying to reproduce, you know, the terrestrial planets of the solar system, the biggest problem at the moment is Mars. It's really hard to get Mars to be the right size in the right place. And so we'll talk a lot more about that. And so the goal of this kind of research is basically, you know, like I'm saying, to reproduce the inner solar system. And given that the giant planets play a really large role in the final assembly of the terrestrial planets, this kind of research can constrain things like Jupiter and Saturn's orbits at early times, for example, because those shape, in some sense, the terrestrial planets. So if we're trying to reproduce the inner solar system, what exactly are we trying to reproduce? So here's a list of, I think, four or five constraints. And so the really stringent ones are at the top and the kind of wimpier ones at the bottom. So we really have to reproduce the masses and orbits of the terrestrial planets. There's no interpretation of those, right? We're pretty sure that they're there. So we got to get those right. And the biggest problem, like I mentioned, is Mars. Mars's small mass is a mystery. We keep forming Marses that are too big. And another thing that had been difficult until a few years ago was getting the really small eccentricities of the terrestrial planets. And just recently, with simulations that include, you know, that really capture the essence of dynamical friction, including that effect makes it possible to get low eccentricities. So, next on the list is the structure of the asteroid belt. So, just kind of in terms of the bulk structure of the asteroid belt, what do I mean here? Well, we have the S and the C types in the asteroids. You know, the inner belt is dominated by dry stuff, the outer belt is dominated by wet stuff, we think. And so in these simulations, the way that we can screw up the asteroid belt is actually by having a planetary embryo, survive for very long times in the asteroid belt. And the reason for that is because the dynamical influence of the embryo can really stir the asteroid belt up, you know, to a larger degree than what we see. Next constraint is the accretion timescales. These are, you know, geochemical measurements. Especially of hafnium-tungsten ratios of rocks from the Earth, the Moon, and even from Mars. And so we have some pretty good constraints on kind of the last core-forming event on these bodies. And so that's probably associated with the last giant impact. And so for the Earth-Moon system, you know, assuming that the last big impact on the Earth was the Moon-forming impact, then that was probably at something like, you know, at least 50 million years that happened, maybe as long as 100 or 150 million years. For Mars, the data is much poorer in quality, and so for Mars, the only thing that really exists is kind of an upper limit. It can't have taken longer than about 10 million years, but it could have taken, you know, 1 million years, maybe even a little bit less than that.
When does zero start?
Ah, good question.
Yeah, like, I mean, hafnium tungsten is CAI formation.
Yeah, it's CAIS, okay. Yeah, so CAI formation is that.
And both of those are from hafnium tungsten?
Yeah, these numbers are from hafnium tungsten. Yeah. And the last constraint that I'll consider here is water on Earth. And so a quite popular model these days is that the Earth's water may have been derived from primitive asteroidal stuff. And I'll show some movies of that process in action. This is the model of Morby et al. From 2000. And that's a nice model because it explains, you know, various aspects of what we see. But it's kind of our weakest constraint because other models do exist. So if we can reproduce everything about the inner solar system except the water, then, you know, we're doing pretty well. On the other hand, if we can reproduce everything except for the masses and orbits of the terrestrial planets, we're not doing so. So that's why I ordered them this way. Okay. So Here's a little bit of background. Most of you probably know this very well, but just kind of let me give you a little schematic view of how we think planets form. So starting from kind of dust up to Earth's, and then even I'll show a little bit of what the gas giants are doing. And here, you know, very rough time scales on the x-axis. So we start off with some dust in the disk. The dust can actually stick together until it reaches some critical threshold, maybe millimeter size, something like that. Then, lately, it's thought that there's some kind of concentration process of maybe millimeters, maybe centimeter, maybe even slightly larger bodies, probably in turbulent structures. You know, those collapse to form planetesimals, which can be anything between, say, a kilometer and maybe even 1,000 kilometers in size. Then, the next phase is kind of, you have a very rapid accretion called runaway growth and kind of a slowing of that process when embryos are interacting with each other. This is about when we think giant planets form, if they're going to form. They have about, you know, a few million years to do so, because after that, most of the gas in the disk is gone. So if you want to form a gas planet, you got to do it while the gas is still there. And then finally, the final stages of accretion of planets like Earth occur after the gas giants have already formed. And we think this is true because, mainly because of those measurements, which suggest that the last large impacts on Earth happened much later than the typical lifetime of gaseous disks. And so you can see during these late phases, you know, it's kind of more stepwise growth. You have lots of collisions between large bodies and that kind of stuff.
Why the little curvature at the end?
Oh, just that's kind of, you know, after you've had your last big impact, you can still accrete some small stuff. There's still a final kind of sweeping up phase of remnant planetesimals that are hanging around.
Does it meet the amount of mass?
I can't. It's usually relatively small. I kind of put it on there to show that it's still happening. But it's, you know, maybe like 1%, that kind of thing. It's not a big thing.
The constraint from siderophile element in the mantle is about 1% of an Earth mass accreted after the dust giant, after the core formation.
Oh, okay. That's good.
Does that assume it's mixed, or does that assume it's all on top?
It's assuming it's mixed in the mantle. But after the core closes, you don't have any siderophile element trapping. When you look at the abundance of the most siderophile elements in the mantle, and you take the typical chondritic composition, and so from the amount of siderophile elements you still have in the mantle that you shouldn't have if the core was broken, and the chondritic composition, there are the total mass accreted, it's about 1%.
So the stuff that the simulations I'm going to show you are from the late stages of accretion. So that final phase. So, you know, how do we choose our initial conditions? Well, we base them on models of the previous stages of growth, in effect. And so we start from populations of planetary embryos and planetesimals. And how do those form? Here's some snapshots from a paper by Kokobo and Ida. And so you can see, you know, in time, you know, the embryos, planetary embryos form kind of as a wave that sweeps outward. They form faster, closer to the star. And, you know, when they form, they kind of, they end up with characteristic sizes, characteristic spacings. And so our inputs into our next, you know, the next phase of growth are going to be kind of things like this, things where you have a characteristic embryo size, characteristic, you know, mass, and a characteristic spacing. And in general, embryos grow by accreting just small guys at the start. And it's only when the local surface density of big guys and small guys is comparable that you end up getting the impacts between the big guys. And so we'll start kind of right around that transition. So we'll put about half the mass in each, half the mass in planetesimals, half the mass in embryos. And, you know, what are the parameters that we can look at? There's kind of two key factors that determine what's going to happen, what you're going to end up with. They're the giant planets, because they play such a large role in the final assembly of the terrestrial planets, basically because we know they're already formed. And in terms of the solar system, you know, generally formation models predict that giant planets should form on quite circular orbits. You know, the eccentricities of Jupiter and Saturn are both, you know, around 5% or so. And so it's thought that they form, you know, probably even more circular than that. You know, there's some stories you can put together for the history of the solar system, like the Nice model. And in the context of the Nice model, it's thought that Jupiter and Saturn probably formed on, you know, relatively circular orbits that were closer together, and maybe even they were trapped in resonances. Maybe the, you know, Jupiter and Saturn were trapped in a 3-2 resonance. And so that's something we're going to take a look at. In terms of the disk properties, we haven't played around with that very much. Typically, it requires something like 5 Earth masses interior to Jupiter's orbit to form, to end up with planets that are about the right mass. So that's the kind of typical disk that we've been using. You can use the minimum mass solar nebula model and have a r to the minus 3/2 surface density profile or, small variations on that. So here, let me show you a movie. I'm going to show you 2 example simulations. And so what we're looking at in these movies is eccentricity or inclination on the y-axis. The inclination is the error bars. Anything that has an inclination more than 5 or 10 degrees has a little error bar, which represents how big its inclination is. And Jupiter's out here, and here is a population of embryos and planetesimals. And we start off with a compositional gradient. And this is purely empirical, so we're not basing this on disk models or anything. It's measured that C-type asteroids, if you assume they're associated with carbonaceous chondrites, have something like 5 or 10% water. Ordinary chondrites in the inner belt are drier than that. Enstatite chondrites, which are kind of at the very inner edge of the belt, are even drier. So we don't have any data for what the stuff that formed the Earth looked like. But we kind of assume that there's, things are getting wetter as you go out here. So if you extrapolate inward, we assume that it's very dry. And so here we go. And so, I forgot to mention, in this case, Jupiter and Saturn's in, included but not shown, and they're in basically the Nice Model 2 condition. So they're in the 3 to 2 resonance. That didn't do what it was supposed to. Here we go. So, what do we see? Things start bouncing around a lot. Dynamical friction keeps the embryo's eccentricities relatively small compared to the planetesimals, as you'd expect. The main source of excitation in the asteroid belt is resonances with Jupiter. In the inner belt, it's just kind of scattering among bodies. You can see the color of these guys are starting to change. That's caused by radial mixing between bodies. So, these guys started off dry, and a little bit of wet stuff is impacting them. That's what causes their colors to change. And things get pretty chaotic there, as you can tell. Right, kind of lots of stuff jumping all over the place. This is a little bit of a weird case, which I picked because I thought it was interesting. You'll see in this case, we end up with 6 terrestrial planets, actually, which is more than usual. It's actually the most I've ever gotten. I thought it was kind of normal, kind of interesting. So, So basically, at the end of this particular simulation, the planets that are around 1 AU are a little bit smaller than the Earth because their mass is basically spread up in more planets than usual. And what else do we see?
You have Jupiter and Saturn in resonance the whole time?
Yeah, they stay in resonance the whole time.
What happens to planetesimals colliding with each other?
Planetesimals can't collide in these simulations. Okay. So the planetesimals have gravity that's felt by the embryos, okay, but not felt by each other. So if you include collisions between planetesimals, then the number of particles you can simulate drops by a factor of a few. So it's not in here. So at the end of this particular case, we get this more planets than usual kind of system. The planets tend to have quite low eccentricities, which is good. The planets at around 1 AU have got some water, which is good. There's a few too many planets, which is not so good. The Mars here is way too big. And another problem is these two guys right here. These are embryos that are about the size of Mars, the real Mars, not this, Mars wannabe thing, which is way too big. These guys are stranded in the asteroid belt, and they're really going to mess things up. So if we look at the outcome of a few different simulations like that, here's 3 different simulations with that same giant planet configuration. And the solar system is shown for scale down here. So you can see this is the simulation we just saw that formed the 6 planets. A typical problem with these simulations is that you end up with large bodies that survive for a long time at 2, 3 AU, something like that. And the problem with that is that they... Oh, actually, before I say that, so the Mars analogs, like I mentioned, are always way too big. Yeah, they're always, factor of 5 or 10, too massive usually. So that doesn't work. And then in terms of the embryos in the asteroid belt, the reason they don't work is you know, if you put an embryo in the asteroid belt and you throw some asteroids in there, the embryo stirs up the asteroids way too much, way more than what we see in terms of, you know, the simple division between S versus C types in the asteroid belt. So even if, you know, during the LHB this embryo was removed, it still wouldn't be consistent with the current asteroid belt because this kind of structure should remain.
Is there gas left here or?
No, by this, I mean, the gas, we start the simulations with no gas, actually. So even if we did include gas, it would be gone within a few million years. So not at this point. So that's, you know, one kind of case that doesn't work too well. It works pretty well in terms of getting Earth and Venus well, you know, right? But it screws up Mars and it screws up the asteroid belt. So here's another case that turns out to work quite a bit better. So what we have here is we have Jupiter and Saturn at their current semi-major axes, but with eccentricities that are a bit higher, so about doubled. And everything else is the same. So you'll see things move quite quickly in this case. So there's a very strong secular resonance at about 2.2 AU, that really chops the system in half very quickly. And so from very early on, kind of the inner system isn't really talking with the asteroid belt anymore. And anytime anything gets a little too close, it ends up in the secular resonance and gets thrown into the sun. So it's a little bit hard to see, but from time to time you can see a little blue speck in there. That's an embryo that early on was kind of scattered from around 2.5 AU into the inner disk. And that's going to turn out to be a really good Mars analog, actually. So it's a little bit hard to see at this point, but it'll show up in a sec. And so in the inner disk, things kind of proceed qualitatively the same as before. You know, there's a chaotic phase. Embryos are bouncing around all over the place. You know, you can see that the things in the inner belt have stayed pretty dry. See, by this point, there's only two embryos on crossing orbits there. That blue one's going to be our good Mars analog. The other one's about to get... Yeah, there he goes. So that one's gone. And so at the end of this simulation, we get pretty good Venus and Earth analogs. Their eccentricities are a little bit too high. They tend to be around, you know, 0.1 or so, you know, about double what we really have. The good thing about this particular simulation is this guy right here. Is it just about the right place and just about the right mass to be a good Mars analog?
Sean, when planetesimals impact the embryos and the embryos grow, it's perfect accretion, right?
Yeah, this is all perfect accretion. Yeah.
So you expect your eccentricity to stay higher than it really would be.
Because we don't have the
we have no chance
debris.
Of creating dynamical friction.
There's no dynamical friction from impact debris.
That's right.
Yeah. That's true. So it's all.
Is there enough mass in that debris to do anything?
That's an open question. I don't know if anyone's done that properly yet. I know people are starting to look at this, but I didn't think it had been.
What's the question? So it's dynamical friction.
Whether there would be enough mass in impact debris. To really circularize things.
Because this is where I was asking what's happening to planetesimals, because if half of the mass is in the small planetesimal initially, their collision time scale is very short, so after a few hundred thousand years,
except
they would
very
be...
excited.
But their collisional dynamical friction would be very efficient for them.
But I think that they would be much more likely to hit the embryos than to hit each other. It's very hard to get them to hit each other.
Even if their size decreases, the same amount of mass would... smaller object, the cross-section will increase.
I know, but their eccentricities are really high, so... And thus their inclinations as well. Mm-hmm. But the gravitational focusing of the big guys is...
But once they're stirred up, the gravitational focusing goes way
down. But they're still not going to hit each other. It's still hard to get them to hit each other. Mm. But I think that we would have dynamical friction somehow. Yeah. Sorry.
No, it's okay. No, this is good.
So in this model, you do not end up with much material from the asteroid belt onto the Earth.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, you know, Earth, this is not such a bad Earth analog, but it's completely dry. And so remember, that's our weakest constraint. So it's not such a big deal, but it is dry. Yeah. And so like I was mentioning before, the reason we can get the good Mars analogs is because of this secular resonance that's sitting around, you know, around 2 AU, which is acting kind of like an edge. So if the system's kind of spreading out by many scattering events, anytime anything gets to about 2 AU, it's gone. And so there's constantly, you know, the scattering among these embryos tends to spread things out. And the tail is completely chopped off by the secular resonance.
How often do you get clippings between the embryos? I'm thinking back to making the moon and things, right?
Oh, how often do we get things living for a long time between the embryos?
No, the embryos colliding. So I was thinking the idea that, you know, you make the moon by hitting something with the Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
People see that very often in simulations?
In these cases, we don't, actually. We have, you know, the moon is thought to have formed in an embryo-embryo collision when the Earth was, I forget exactly what, half its current mass? No. 0.8, 0.9 of its current mass with a Mars-sized impactor. And we actually looked at every impact in all of our simulations, all the last few impacts, to see if we could reproduce Robin Canup's criterion for, you know, the right angle and the right speed and so on. And we don't get those. I talked with H.
Do you get Mars-sized impactors? You must get Mars-sized impactors.
Yeah, we get plenty of impactors. We just don't get the slow offset ones at late times. And I think that's probably because we have perfect accretion. I was talking with H.R.O. Kokobo about this, and they have a code where each time there's a giant collision, they go and have a lookup table of SPH collisions between embryos. And so they, you know, they look at what the outcome should have been. And he says that, you know, on second chance impacts, those are much more likely to be moon-forming type impacts because they tend to, you know, be relatively lower velocity.
Here you have a weak dynamical friction, but for instance, in the paper with O'Brien or Morishima was explaining moon-forming events in the simulation, and Agnor et al. Back in 1999, yeah. Over there in Thompson. So.
Yeah.
That might tell you how much damping there is, right? In a rough sense, it's one event, of course, but it tells you what the typical AV infinity is.
I don't know if it's typical, but yeah, you get one of them, yeah. All right, so with this kind of setup, with the eccentric Jupiter and Saturn, here's the outcome of four simulations again. And so the Earth and Venus look pretty good. Mars looks pretty good. In each of these cases, Mars is a lot smaller than in the previous situations. It's usually about the right mass. I think this is the one, this is the one that I showed you the movie of. And actually, Mars is too small in that case. It's about half of its current mass. But we're not worrying about Mars being too small, so that's not a big deal. These simulations also have the advantage of not stranding embryos in the asteroid belt quite so often. So it happened, you know, in two out of four cases here.
Why don't we care? Mars is too small?
Oh, I mean, we want Mars to be the right size, but we've had this big problem of having Mars way too big. So now if Mars is a little bit too small...
It's way too small.
Yeah, if it's way too small.
No, whoa.
But it's,
okay.
I mean, we've...
But I'm saying, why? Where is the rest of the mass
going to
come from?
Oh, well, I mean, in that case, it's done, right?
Let me ask you this.
So it's not quite just the solar system, but it's... Yeah. Instead of being 5 or 10 times too big, it's, you know, it's half the size.
So in these runs,
so it's better.
Sorry, so related to that, in these runs you saw some of them, right, where you eject Mars-like objects, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at these runs and you look at things that have been ejected, and you look at that whole population, so imagine you've got 2 or 3 or 4 objects in that region,
mm-hmm.
and you've ejected N-1 of them.
Mm-hmm.
Do any of them have Mars-like masses?
Yeah, that's pretty common.
So if you imagine you had 3 or 4 objects in there and you just randomly keep one, but some of them are close to Mars mass, then it's not so bad, is it?
Yeah, sure. Or, you know, there were those 2 embryos hanging around towards the end that had a bunch of encounters, and finally one of them was thrown into the sun. If they had collided, it'd be almost just right. So it's we don't have a problem with Mars being too small yet. Anyway. So overall these look a lot better, right? We still have the problem, but we have a new problem that Earth is not getting much water. That's because this resonance is basically chopping the inner and outer planetary system in half, but we're not stranding stuff in the asteroid belt, and we're getting Mars to be about the right size. The biggest problem with this is that it doesn't allow for any migration of the giant planets. So the way we have this set up is Jupiter and Saturn have their current semi-major axes. So that means, you know, if anything's going on in the outer planetary system, it's going to affect, you know, by scattering of planetesimals, it's going to affect Jupiter and Saturn. And it would tend to spread their orbits out, you know, until they're too far apart. So with this particular setup, it doesn't work because You can't have any late migration. Basically, you can kind of equate the time scale of migration with the time scale for the formation of Mars, because that's the thing that really needs that strong secular resonance in some sense. And so that means that the whole outer solar system would have had to do its thing in less than 10 million years. And none of the models for the outer solar system do it that fast. So
what is the secular resonance?
Oh, it's the nusix. Yeah, it's the same nusix we have today at the inner edge of the astro belt. It's just stronger because the eccentricities are higher. So kind of to summarize the effects of where the giant planets are in these kind of models, here's a few different panels. In each of these cases, we're looking at the semi-major axis versus mass of simulated planets, and the actual terrestrial planets are the squares. Okay. So the cases with quite eccentric Jupiter and Saturn that we just saw are up here. So you can see we do a pretty good job of getting, you know, Earth and Venus in more or less the right spot. Do a good job of getting Mars-type things, and not too much stuff in the asteroid belt. On the other hand, this was the case that I showed you at the very start with very circular orbit for Jupiter and Saturn. And in that case, you get a lot of massive planets around where Mars is, and you get a lot of embryos stuck in the asteroid belt. And here are two kind of intermediate cases, which they're probably not really worth talking about. These are just kind of slight variations, changing around exactly where the giant planets' orbits are and their eccentricities. They're both intermediate between these two.
What happens if you put exactly the current orbits of the giant planets?
Okay. I will talk about it then. It's this one.
Oh.
So the trouble with that is it's not actually self-consistent, because during the accretion process, Jupiter has close encounters and ejects a lot of material, which then in turn decreases its eccentricity, and also its semi-major axis, but just a little bit. But its eccentricity tends to go down 2 or 3% during accretion by ejecting embryos and planetesimals that start off in the outer asteroid belt. And so to actually be consistent with the current orbits, you have to start them a little bit higher. But in the case of just kind of assuming, you know, sticking them on their current orbits and letting it go, it works pretty well. I mean, it's you can get Earth and Venus pretty well. You get Mars a little bit too big, but it's an improvement over circular orbits. And then there's, if you want to look in more detail at other metrics, you can look at things like this is the angular momentum deficit of the planets scale to Earth, scale to the inner solar system, which is one in these units, versus the last giant impact, for example. So this shaded region would be successful outcomes, within a factor of 2 in terms of the angular momentum deficit. And you can see, we're not getting too many things in there, but there's a few. Then you can look in terms of the angular momentum deficit and some kind of radial mass concentration factor. And that's the one that it's actually very difficult to reproduce. What this number means is how radially concentrated the mass in the planets is. And so for the terrestrial planets, it's actually very high, because all the mass is in Venus and Earth, which are very close together. And we tend to get larger planets, not necessarily larger, but generally more widely spaced. And if you just have one large thing at Mars's distance, for example, this metric drops by a lot. So instead of being at 1 in these units, you'd be at 0.3 or 0.5, something like that. So we have a few outcomes that kind of just barely satisfy both of those, both the radial mass concentration and the angular momentum deficit. And we got some of these, but unfortunately there's no overlap between those. So this is kind of like a negative result. We can't, with these particular models, we haven't succeeded in getting these numbers right. And now I'll kind of jump in and discuss some other recent work on this topic. There was an interesting paper that came out just a couple months ago by Brad Hansen, where he managed to reproduce pretty much all of these aspects of the solar system, except for the water one. And the way he did it was by taking completely ad hoc initial conditions and assuming that instead of starting with this disk of stuff, from point something AU out to, out to Jupiter's orbit, you only have embryos from 0.7 to 1 AU. You also have planetesimals also, but it's only between 0.7 and 1 AU. So it's not really well reproduced here, but so basically this is a 1 AU, oops, right there, and points up. So that's where everything starts off. Then if you kind of let it go and let it accrete, like I was saying, during scattering it tends to spread things out. And you can end up forming a pretty good Mars, actually. You still get Earth and Venus pretty well. And you even get something that, you know, maybe is going to turn into Mercury. And so this is something that's really weird that, you know, if you take initial conditions that there's no great reason to choose, you can get a better answer than if you take things that you think have a reason for being there.
Did these include the giant planets?
He did, yeah. Yeah. Or at least just, I think just Jupiter, but yeah.
But that matters, because then you don't have New 6.
It's true. But New 6 is here. Doesn't matter. Yeah, but there's actually New 5, which is right around here, if you had the current architecture. So, he did include Jupiter and Saturn. Was there another question?
But basically, it's just selecting initial condition that comes from the current initial condition, current state, right, that most are massive in Earth and Venus.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's tailored. It's initial conditions that are not chosen based on what we think disks look like. They're chosen to get the terrestrial planets right, but they actually work really well. So it's kind of surprising, because we've been coming at it from the other point of view, and it hasn't worked. And if you choose these things that seem ad hoc, you can actually get it to work pretty well. You don't get any water, obviously, because, you know, our source of water would be off the scale. But, you know, that was our weakest constraint in some sense. So that's one kind of interesting thing. And there's also been some models that included many other effects. And Makiko is going to talk about some of those. And there's one other paper that I want to mention that's just coming out soon in Icarus by Morishima et al. And they included a bunch of gas disk effects, including a type 1 migration. So they have a gas disk that hangs around for a few million years, and they include the effects of damping and gas drag and so on. And here's one kind of interesting simulation that they have where they form four planets in the end. And so here you see their orbital distances versus time. And so, you know, they're kind of growing. Actually, they're not growing too much by this point, but they start to feel the effects of the gas. And they have a phase of type 1 migration, and then they keep growing. These are just the seeds that we're seeing. And in the end, this particular realization, they get four planets that are in orbits pretty close to the inner solar system. The problem is, if you kind of match up the colors with the masses, the outer planets are the massive ones, and the, you know, Venus, Earth analogs are the least massive of the two. So this is not quite working. And they looked at a large range of cases, and they basically had the same conclusions that we did, that they couldn't get it to work in some sense. So there's no set of initial conditions that gives you, you know, radially concentrated terrestrial planets, gives you a small Mars, and all these constraints. And that doesn't mean it doesn't exist, it's just something's missing. So one other effect that I'll mention real quick is, maybe, you know, we've just been playing around with the giant planets mainly. You know, maybe it's some disk effect that we didn't consider. And Jin et al. In 2008 had this, they basically proposed, you know, what if there's dead zones in disks, basically, such that the inner disk has a relatively high viscosity, the outer disk has a relatively high viscosity, but in between, you know, the viscosity is very low. Then basically just from the way the disk spreads out, you get a little blip. And so you get a pileup of material between the, you know, the dead zone and the higher viscosity outer part, and you get a decrease in the surface density between the dead zone and the higher viscosity inner part. And that blip, you know, it's not that deep. It's maybe a factor of 5 or so in the local surface density. Is it about, in their model anyway, is it about 1.5, you know, 2 AU, something like that? And so it's possible that such a thing could work and maybe prevent embryos from forming at Mars's distance. I've done a few tests, and it doesn't seem like this really works, because the spreading out effect of, you know, during accretion is, you know, spreads things out a lot more than the width of this kind of blip. But it's possible that maybe some kind of variation on this could, you know, help. So to summarize my portion, so far we can't reproduce all of our constraints for the inner solar system at the moment. The closest we can do is having Jupiter and Saturn on their current orbits, but more eccentric. Except the problem there is that it's not really consistent with the solar system as a whole. Including the gas disk effects doesn't seem to solve the problem, according to a new paper. And it's really hard to get Mars to be small enough. You know, this constrains Jupiter and Saturn's orbits early on, or maybe our initial conditions are way off and embryos only formed in a tiny little annulus, which would be interesting. And, you know, what's missing? We're not really sure. One thing that I haven't talked at all about is a model by Makiko and others that includes secular resonance sweeping during the dispersal of the gas. So maybe I can take some questions now, and then we'll pass it on to Makiko. So, anyone have any questions based on this kind of stuff, or topics of discussion?
Yeah. Why Mu6 in your simulator? Why Mu6 can divide the Mu6 can divide the system into two regions? Why Mu5 couldn't?
In our case, it just wasn't strong enough. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good point.
Is that a function of the eccentricities you put in?
Yeah, I mean that must be a function of the eccentricities of Jupiter and Saturn. And I guess in our configuration, Saturn's eccentricity was higher just because when they're secularly, Saturn's eccentricity tends to be higher. But I guess you can imagine a situation where if Jupiter and Saturn's orbits were both, you know, significantly more eccentric, Nu 5 could be a lot stronger. I think I have a plot here of the, where did I put this? Yeah, here's the plot of the actual eccentricity of test particles. In that configuration, this is this bottom one. And so you see the new 6 one is really strong right here. And new 5 is still giving pretty good eccentricities to these massless test particles. But it's not enough to really have that same effect. Yeah.
When you did the different realizations, was it such that the eigenmodes had different amplitudes or was it such that all the realizations have the same power in each mode?
I think they had the same. I mean, the Jupiter and Saturn were exactly the same. It's only the inner stuff that was changed.
And there's the eccentricity, and then there's you can have the modes have more power, but just sort of conspiring against each other, so that initial eccentricity is small. So I guess I'm wondering, when you do a few realizations, do you make sure that you try both sort of high mode excitation for a given eccentricity and low modes, or do you have it so they're all the same?
No, I haven't. We haven't looked at that exactly. We generally start with the giant planets on exactly the same orbits, and then just change the inner disk stuff. But we haven't thought about.
His question: when we excite the change the eccentricities to increase them by a factor of 2, we just increase the eccentricity by a factor of 2, without paying attention that both the eigenmode of Mu6, G6, and G5 increase. So it might turn out that our initial eccentricity is a factor of 2 higher, but actually only the G6 eigenmode is excited by a factor of 2 or 3 and not the G4. But one of the reasons for which Nu6 is extraordinarily more powerful than Nu5 is that it falls in a place where there is no quadratic term in the Hamiltonian. In other words, at 2 AU, the precession of the perihelion frequency does not depend on the eccentricity. So if you are in resonance, the resonance changes your eccentricity. But if changing your eccentricity, you don't change your precession frequency, you keep staying in the resonance and go away forever. At 1 AU or 0.7 AU, this is not true. So the resonance tends to excite the eccentricity. As the eccentricity changes, your frequency changes. So eventually you leave the resonance and you stop.
That should be a generic
problem. This is the degeneracy problem in the quadratic part of the Hamiltonian is really specific of where Nu6 falls. When, for instance, you approach Jupiter and Saturn to each other, so that Nu6 falls at 3 AU, then Nu6 is not powerful enough to throw stuff into the Sun again, because again we have a dependency on eccentricity of the eccentricity. So it's really a conspiracy between amplitude of the eigenmode and location of the resonance. It makes this resonance very odd.
Okay. Cool. I'll pass it off to Makiko then.
So next, I'll talk about the very specific topic of the effect of the sweeping secular resonance in forming terrestrial planets. So I think people in this room knows very well about the problem of the sweeping secular resonance, but let me remind you again about the role of the sweeping secular resonance using next maybe 15 minutes. And sweeping secular resonance, under some conditions, the sweeping of the secular resonance works badly in the terrestrial planet regions, as Mowgli was anxious about it in the old NIST model. But I'd like to show you here, sometimes it's also good in accelerating the formation of terrestrial planets. Sweeping secular resonance can take place in a system that there is a perturbing planet and slow change of potential. And the changing of the potential can happen in various situations, such as the migration of planet or dissipation of the planetesimal disk, or even by the changing of the rotation speed of the central star. But in this talk, I'll forget about the migration of planets and others, very complicated ones. So I'm concentrating on the sweeping secular resonance caused by the disk depletion. As Finn showed, at the end stage of organic growth, many planetesimals are in the terrestrial planet regions. And I'm not sure whether the massive gas disk is there or not, but at least at the point in time Jupiter starts a gas accretion, there is a gas disk. So let's think there was a minimum mass gas disk in this stage. At this moment, the secular resonance nu 5 is Venus, near the Venus orbit, around 0.58. But in this configuration, the nu 5 occurs near the location of Jupiter because the gas disk changes the precession rate of the planetesimals and the planets. And after the Jupiter formed, the gas disk starts to deplete. Then, so the location of nu 5 depends on the mass of the gas disk. So it moves from here to current location, passing through the terrestrial planet region. And if the secular resonance is enough strong, or it moves enough slowly, it can excite the eccentricity of particles, overcoming the damping force due to the planetesimal disk or gas disk. So it excites the eccentricity of particles near the resonance and leads the collisions of particles. But after collisions, the resonance has gone, and still there is a gas disk. So the planets receive a drag force and its eccentricity is down again. So this is the idea of the sweeping secular resonance caused by disk division. This is an example of numerical simulations of this process. So this is the major axis, and this is time. And initially, about 40 protoplanets are isolated in terrestrial planet region between 0.7 AU to 4 AU in this case. And blue line shows the evolution of the major axis of each protoplanet. And the protoplanets are given the isolation mass of minimum mass disk with mutual separation of 10 Hill radius. And Jupiter is around here at current locations with current eccentricity in this case. This red line shows the location of the secular resonance. Before the disk depletion, it's around 3 AU. And it moves towards the sun as the disk dissipates, like this. So near the resonance, the eccentricity of planetesimals are excited. And because of this excitation, they start to feel the gas drag force from the disk. So the semi-major axis goes down also. And effect of both eccentricity excitation and the damping of semi-major axis, the orbit near the resonance becomes unstable and they start to collide with each other. The instability starts from the outer regions and it propagates into the inner region. But the outside of the resonance, there is still enough gas, so the eccentricity is dumped quickly. And the formed planet, the eccentricity in the formed planet is effectively dumped by the gas drag. And this is the final system in this case. And this small bar shows the orbital excursion, so that is the magnitude of eccentricity. For comparison, this is the solar system, terrestrial planet in the solar system, in the same scale. So we can have something like the solar system in this case. But of course, the end stage of the organic growth is a highly chaotic stage, so the results should be argued statistically. This is a histogram of the major axis of 30 runs. In each simulation, normally we have 3 or 4 planets. And this is a histogram for the largest planet, and this is for the second largest, and it's a smaller planet. So always, the probability of the largest planet has a peak near the location of the Earth. And the second largest planet, normally Venus, are formed at either side of the largest planet. The probability is the same. And smaller planets avoid the region of the largest planet and the second largest planet. So this is a Martian, it's a mass case. And in simulations, mass consists of 1 or 2 protoplanets. That are originally around 2 AU. So large Earth is coming with the secular resonance and scattered it, the scatter the small protoplanet, and it will be mass. And as he showed before, the similar result can be obtained even in a classical case without using sweeping secular resonance if the simulation area is restricted within the mass.
Oh, what was that?
Sorry?
I didn't see the understanding your last.
Okay. If you simulate the planetary formation within Martian orbit, within the orbit of Mars.
Yeah. So you only have a restricted.
So if you simulate
so
the same
one,
like only using this planet, this mass.
Right.
Yeah, but in the case of sweeping secular resonance, the final result is not sensitive to the initial radial extent of the protoplanet. And it's all this area all clear.
Nikki Hill, I'm sorry. What,
I know you've told us this many times, but what is Jupiter doing? It's at its current mass, at its current location.
Yes, with, yeah.
With low eccentricity, right?
Current
orbit.
Yeah, point. Yeah, in this specific case, I put 0.05 eccentricity of Jupiter. And the same as a... in this case, Saturn is also included, and it has 0.05 also.
But it's current.
Current one. So not like Nice model.
Right.
Do you have migrations of the embryos?
It's due to the damping of eccentricity. So I don't include the type 1 migrations, but damping force of eccentricity. So when eccentricity goes down, it also eccentricity goes down. So it's something like a gyrosphere.
Right.
But it's a gravitational.
Yeah. The centimeter axis is.
No.
Yes.
Yeah.
Another difference with the classical case is a collisional timing. It may be good, but it may be not good. But in the classical case, the collisions cannot take place until the damping force become relatively weak. But in this case, the collisions are forced by the sweeping secular resonance. So the formation timing is depending on the timing of the sweeping secular resonance, that is the timing of the disk depletion time scale. Normally, it's much earlier than the case of classical case. And of course, since there is a damping, the eccentricity and inclinations are different, and they are normally smaller than the classical case. So this figure shows the final eccentricity and inclinations in such runs. Blue are planets formed in simulations, and red points are time average eccentricity of terrestrial planets. And actually, it oscillates in this range. So normally, the agreement of eccentricity and inclinations is good in this case. But the efficiency of the sweeping secular resonance depends on the eccentricity of planets and the disk depletion time scale. So if the eccentricity of Jupiter is smaller than current values, or disk depletion timescale is much shorter, it's a combination, the final result becomes similar to the classical case. And in the solar system, I can get something analogous to the solar system, but in extrasolar planets, we have various versions of Jupiter. So the location of the secular resonance and the strength is depend on the system. This is an example of the system. Here is two big eccentric planets. And these were parameters of mu Arae, but after the simulations, fourth planets are discovered, and actually the eccentricity is much smaller. But anyway, let's see the effect of this eccentric planet as an example. The figure shows the location of secular resonance versus disk mass. So it's like a time. And here is three different models, but basically secular resonance comes in until the effect of general relativity becomes important. And also, this resonance is very strong because of the mass of the planet and the eccentricity. So it can gather everything in this region. And it happened to form a large planet around here at the location of hot Neptune. Another example is the initial condition of Nice model. So if the eccentricity is almost zero, the secular resonance does nothing. But even if the eccentricity is not zero, when the Saturn is close to Jupiter, the secular resonance cannot happen in a right timing and right location. So again, the final system tends to be eccentric. So the strength of the secular resonance depends on the magnitude of eccentricity and mass and symmetry axis of the perturbing planet, and also depend on the time scale of the potential change. If the secular resonance is strong, and it happens in the condition that there is a damping force, we tend to have a massive terrestrial planets in a relatively compact region, and they would be circular. But in multiple planetary systems, other than solar system, everything depends on how strongly the resonance passes through and where it stops. And if we couldn't finish the assemblage of the terrestrial planet before the in the condition that the damping force is effective, quite often we have orbital instability in the later stage, and all regions are stirred up, and the terrestrial planets tend to be very eccentric again. On the other hand, if the sweeping secular resonance is too strong, like in the case of short pillar planet in the eccentric in the exoplanetary systems, they gather everything near the star. And same kind of sweeping secular resonance can happen in other type of potential change, like a slow migration of planet. So when we think about the terrestrial planet formations in extrasolar planetary systems, we should be very careful on the effect of sweeping secular resonance. So that's it. I take the question. Maybe you want to know the water content?
Oh. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Give us that on that.
Yeah, I had a question on the comment. The comment is that, as you said, this mechanism really relies on Jupiter and Saturn
That's
having
right.
the current separation when they are still embedded in the disk,
yes.
gas disk.
Yeah.
And what we see in hydrodynamical simulation, I think Richard will agree with me, is that they can't stay there. The gas disk forces the two planets to converge to each other and go into some resonance.
That's right.
So there is a sort of, I mean, this is by far, your simulations are by far those which produce the best terrestrial planets, but they have this original sin. That it's not a small one, we should really understand.
Yes.
I mean, speaking about, well, I mean, the planets migrating radially, once the gas goes away, migrating radially early, well, you can explain the LHB. Forget about the LHB, so on and so forth. But as long as there is gas, which is required to move the resonance, the planets should not be on the orbit where they are, because type 2 torques push them one against the other. So this is too bad. I mean, that's the original scene.
Yeah, but anyway, you need to think about the sweeping of the secular resonance.
Yeah.
In any case, it may work and it may not work,
sure,
but
sure.
you have to think about it.
Sure, I fully agree. But if, for instance, the planets are in resonance with each other, their precession is even reversed. So the secular resonance is totally elsewhere. Right? And then I had a question. I noticed for the first time, actually, that your embryos migrate surfing on the location of the resonance. Right? You said you're not taking into account type 1. So it's a migration associated to the eccentricity thing. How well is that known? How well do we know how much the semi-major axis move as their eccentricity is damped? Because, for instance, in the Tanaka and Ward paper,
mm-hmm.
I think they give formula for eccentricity inclination damping, but there is no prescription for semi-major axis change apart from type 1, which could change totally if the disk is not isothermal or turbulent or whatever. So how well do we know? I mean, this is a question in general for you, for Richard, for Fengjin. I don't know, actually. How well do we know how the semi-major axis should change during type 1 damping? And how sensitive your result is to your prescription of migration with damping?
I have some result with different strengths of the damping.
Okay. Yeah?
But maybe it's not answer your question itself.
How much does it affect the end result, though?
Sorry?
How much does the change in your prescription, how much does your prescription affect your end result, I think?
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I thought that the eccentricity damping was always faster than the migration. Is that not true?
Oops.
Oh, turning to each other.
And if it is, then using it is fine. You just damp the eccentricity and let, you know, then this
No, but this is important for her mechanism that as the body goes up in eccentricity and the damping operates, it moves enough in some major axis so that it surfs on the resonance. And it comes in together with the resonance, like a surfer does on the wave. So if your some major axis doesn't move, it's like when you're not pedaling fast enough and don't catch the wave and you're surfing. And the wave passes and you're just there. And so it's critical. I mean, I'm not sure, but I think it's relatively critical here. Have inward migration and the rate of.
So if they're not proportional, this wouldn't work, but if they are proportional, it does, because usually it's assumed they are.
I don't know.
Is that the.
So Mahiga, so you're not including type 1 migration?
No.
And so what's your prescription for eccentricity damping?
Speed damping is probably can happen work.
Not Tanaka's, but do I have the patient?
There is this Lee and Field prescription that it can damp only the eccentricity
so
and not
just
change the same image.
Yeah,
that
would be bad.
Like
that
yeah.
would be bad here. Yeah.
Actually, it's included as a, like a totally like a gastroc. So if it's the motion is. Differs from the Keplerian orbit, it feels a drag.
So it's basically a prescribed damping.
Yes.
Like
it is effectively a gastroc,
sorry.
It is a gastroc.
Yeah, but
it
depends on this.
But it is. But that's what she was saying was causing the damping in the first place. Because
yeah, that's why some major
actually
moves.
The eccentricity gets excited. The resonance goes, and now you're embedded in the gastroc.
No,
so
I didn't realize it was gastroc.
No. But it is a gastroc.
What do you get in your damping simulation?
Gastroc only effective for
small well, I mean, type 2, sorry, in type 1, it's a factor of h over r squared in the ratio of migration rate to eccentricity damping rate, very much faster, so the damping time scale, as we already know, is a few tens of years for a couple of Earth mass bodies sitting inside a minimum mass nebula. This time scale here, I don't know how that relates to numbers of a few tens of years, 500,000 years. Is that 5,000 years? 5,000 years. 0.1?
But this is 5,000 years for a 0.01 Earth mass.
0.1 or
0.01?
0.1.
So the time scale is like tens of years, less of 10 or so the time scale for the damping is like those of your paper.
Yeah, exactly.
But again, it's not clear to me how much the same major axis has to move. Making a fractional type 1 migration,
yes,
may or may not exist, how much eccentricity damping, how much same major axis migration should the eccentricity damping do?
That I don't know.
Can I also ask if your what's the math? So, do you have a problem with your Mars being too big?
Mass.
Less than everybody else.
Because the smaller ones get scattered away from everything else, so they are the outermost.
The depletion of the asteroid belt is so dramatic and rapid.
Okay.
It's like
maybe
Hansen.
Two problems. Maybe it's cleared too much and maybe mixed up everything too much in the asteroid region.
And what happens if you have planetesimals in there also besides just the protoplanets?
If you feel the air gesture, it will most of them also migrated because of this drug. And almost 10 kilometer size are all gone, and only 100 kilometer size will be left in this way.
The final orbital distribution is not very good, no? It's too high inclinations.
It depends on the way of the disk depletion. In the case of uniform depletion, maybe you can excite the inclinations, but not inclinations. And also, and maybe it's hard to remain particles, many particles in asteroid region.
I still don't understand why it migrates in the same major axis. I mean, because you only change the eccentricity, right? You don't change the major axis externally.
The equation I showed you is not an equation I used in the simulations. In the simulations, it feels like a gas drag, so the velocity difference from the Kepler orbit are affected as
okay,
a damping.
Okay.
But they do the eccentricity down damping through a gas drag.
That can
right.
change.
And that changes it.
But that changes also the angular momentum, not just the energy of the orbit. I mean, that might be what happens in type 1 is that primarily you're damping the eccentricity through getting rid of the energy, keeping the angular momentum of the orbit approximately constant, so it tends towards a semi-major axis, which corresponds to a circular orbit with that angular momentum. In this particular system, I think, where you have a gas drag, you're actually explicitly including torques, aren't you? So it may be that the angular momentum of the system also changing. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Not clear how you compare the two actual procedures for damping eccentricity. How they affect the semi-major axis. But in type 1, you tend to damp towards an orbit with a well-defined angular momentum, and then type 1 migration drives the semi-major axis by applying a torque to that circular orbit. Kind of different.
Again, it would be really easy to check by just putting in another prescription for the
eccentricity damping. There are prescriptions for eccentricity damping, don't touch it or something like that.
It's in this Lee and Field 2002 or so, it would be usable as well.
Right.
So if there is only eccentricity damping, I think I have a larger materials in the outer region. So again, I think we have a very huge mass.
What about the water? You're touching that?
Yeah. Quickly, I'll show you. In our case, normally mass is dry because it's a scatter from around 2 AU. It's a picture like as it's the same kind of simulations that you did. Normally, Earth is wet. It acquires about half of the mass in the asteroid belt, so it's too much wet. I think it's like an ocean planet, and I think it's too much water will be. So maybe shall we go over there?
Yeah, I guess maybe we should move up to the coffee, something like that. Yeah, okay.